welcome to that transitional point once again between a Saturday afternoon and a Saturday evening here on 90.7 FM, KALX Berkeley. It is time for the program Film Close-Ups. My name is Greg Sharpen. I'm going to be your host for the next hour, talking about Indie Fest today. I'm going to be talking about two films in particular that are going to be screening at this year's San Francisco Independent Film Festival. In around half an hour, we're going to be talking about the film Cat Daddies, a documentary about men and their cats. A variety of different men, kind of all over the nation, and their relationships with their cats. An extraordinarily, extraordinarily adorable film, one that I will confess to being somewhat predisposed to like, but I imagine a number of you out there are probably in that same boat. But before we get to that, for the first half hour, we're going to be talking about the documentary The Creative High, a documentary about nine people who have come through addiction and are trying to transition out of addiction, and the role that their creativity and their art is taking to help them combat their addiction. Art ranging from music to dance to theater to visual art, sculpture, painting, kind of runs photography, runs the whole gamut of artistic expression. I had a chance to talk with the film's director, Adriana Marchion, and also the film's producer, Diane Griffin. So without further ado, a conversation about the documentary The Creative High, here for you on 90.7 FM. KALX Berkeley, the program Film Close-Ups. I'm wondering which came first in terms of the beginning of the film. Did you have the artists first and then kind of arrived at the conceit, or did you have the conceit first and then go hunting for artists that would fit into the idea of addiction and recovery and using art to try and work your way out of addiction?
It started with the concept, and I have so much of my work has been about supporting creative people in recovery or supporting people with addictions to find a creative path, because I'm also an arts therapist, an expressive arts therapist to be exact. And so I spent a lot of my life doing this work. And so when it came to finding another topic, because this is my second film, my first was a short film, this is my first feature, this felt like a natural topic, because I'm so passionate about it. So that came first, and then the artists were chosen based on the topic. Some of the artists I had already known through my career. I'm also in recovery myself. I've been in recovery for 28 years, and so I have a pretty large network. And so there was a couple people like Ralph Spite, who's a musician and has a history of punk music. I already knew him through that recovery world. And Kathy Page, who's a painter, I already knew her, and Jason Bernhardt, stone sculptor. So there was connection to each of them. So that was an easy piece to just, really start having a dialogue and invite them in. And then a lot of the other artists came through different avenues. Lessa Clark, who's an interdisciplinary artist, she actually was a student of mine, and I had watched and followed her recovery journey. And then our associate producer, Travis Rowland, introduced us to two of the artists, Luis Canales and Peter Griggs, who were both performance artists and drag performers from the queer community here in San Francisco. And the list goes on. I can keep going. There was some artists that originally that I interviewed at the very outset that didn't make the cut, because it just didn't feel like the right, it wasn't fitting with the other artists and the content. And Diane, do you want to jump in with anything too? Like, it's good always to speak about Joan, I think, too.
Right. Well, thanks, Adriana. I just wanted to say most of the subjects had already been chosen and were a part of the project when I came on. There were a couple that weren't, like Joan, who's a photographer and works in theater. And we wanted to have a representation of San Francisco, you know, the people in San Francisco. And so we were shaping it. We shaped it. And surprisingly, the subjects, you know, when we started really working into what the story was going to look like and how we were going to represent nine artists so they could be heard, you know, the interweaving of these stories, we made three chapters. And
I mean, I think it's interesting that you've managed to get this through the breadth that you managed to have, you know, the breadth of artistic practices, the breadth of age ranges, the breadth of, you know, pretty much any metric that you can think of. You have a pretty broad spectrum encapsulated in just nine artists, which I think mm-hmm. is pretty commendable.
yeah, we start out, we have artists, you know, we have artists in early recovery, and you know, I really relate to a lot of those artists myself. Lessa, she's really our emotional content in the film, her willingness and all our artists' willingness to be vulnerable and open, where they are at now, where they were at, and just share those stories.
Yeah, that was the thing that I was heading towards, is that the sort of the different stages of sobriety that you have. Lessa, I think in the interview said she's 70 days. She was at I think at 70 days.
Right.
In the film,
yeah,
and then
she's 70 days sober. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you have people who have, you know, have been clean for years and sort of that. So that I'm wondering if we could maybe talk about sort of where people were at the different stages where they were, and sort of discuss that breadth in the film.
I think that it was really important for me, for sure, to not just speak to one element of recovery, right, in terms of, because there's so many variables, and there's also now, I mean, there's so many pathways for people to get sober and to, you know, get into recovery, right? Whether it's drugs or alcohol. And somebody like Louise, who is a dancer, a performer, you know, he was still really actively struggling when we started filming him. And I thought he was further along than he actually was. So he was practicing harm reduction, and it wasn't going so well for him actually at the time. And then we had somebody like, let's say, Wes Geer, who founded Rock to Recovery and is a musician. And he has, I think, about 12 years of recovery now. And, you know, just really such a strong foothold in recovery. And then there's like some Kathy Page, who has, she's in her, I think she's close to 30 years in recovery. So I think having these different perspectives really just adds a lot to the film, because there's different wisdom that comes to it, and there's a different kind of raw quality from folks that are still, you know, kind of new. Like Brandon in the film had 5 years, our hip hop artist, and, you know, was bringing his perspective to his journey. So I think I really like that about it as well. It feels very rich to me.
Let's maybe talk about organizing principles. You mentioned the idea that it's three chapters, and it's three groupings of three. And the, I mean, probably the most difficult and the greatest back and forth in trying to construct a documentary are the organizing principles. How we have all this material, how do we now fit it into some sort of comprehensible flow and structure? Mm-hmm. So how did you arrive at your organizing principle, and how many different iterations did you have of trying to work the material into the form it's in?
Right. Well, when I
interminable.
When I came onto the documentary, that was one of the, you know, I kept saying to Audrey, "You've got too many people. You've got too many people here," you know, and she's like, "Well, no, this is really important. I need these people. I really want. This is what I envision." And so, you know, eventually, you know, I was trying to think, you know, how are we going to do this? And then, you know, this idea of grids in the beginning too, we see these little images appearing and disappearing, and we see these faces, and some of them are doing the creative process, and then we move into Louise dancing. And Adriana and I had always thought about just how strong that dance moving us, he's kind of welcoming us into their stories. And then, you know, it just started flowing into these chapters. What are we going to call these chapters, you know?
I also want to just really credit Diane for, because of, I mean, again, like I said, this is my second film, and Diane has been making documentaries for over 25 years, and so bringing her on as producer was probably one of the best, you know, decisions I've definitely made, because it just raised it to a whole other standard and level of quality. And I remember distinctly being in this with our editor, Kirk Goldberg, and we were together and just grappling with this, like, how is this going to work? It's such a mess streaming all these stories together and trying to weave back and forth. And it just felt like I couldn't get a grasp on it. And just, I don't know where, it must have been a moment of inspiration, Diane, or you've done this, maybe, I don't know where it came from, maybe you could tell where exactly, but it was like all of a sudden she's like, let's do it in three chapters. And the three of us, it was like an epiphany. And it was like all of a sudden things started flowing and right. we had the structure. It was really an amazing moment.
But how did you decide how the trios were going to fit together? Was there, I mean, how much, or were there people who migrated from chapter to chapter, or did the chapters coalesce as soon as the idea of the chapters arose?
I think pretty, at least for me, and I believe we all were in agreement, it was pretty clear right away who would go.
It was.
Where.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was, I think that was also part of the epiphany. It was like, oh, right. The folks that are in earlier recovery who are still kind of struggling with their sobriety or their, you know, finding their way, that they would go at the beginning. And then there was a little bit more of like the gritty, edgy. We got the punk, we got the drag, we got, you know, we got Joan, who really, our photographer, producer, she just has kind of a nice edge to her, I feel. And then,
which is interesting because you wouldn't think, yeah. I mean, looking at her or encountering her, you wouldn't think that there would be that kind of edge to her. And that's kind of, it's a lovely surprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 She's a very quiet, powerful kind of presence, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah.
Yeah, she is. She is. But because of where she went, you know, with her addiction, I mean, with heroin and how far down she went and then what she's been able to do is quite remarkable.
And then the final chapter being the people who have had a longer history of sobriety behind them at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's not necessarily that they all have a longer history of sobriety. So Kathy does. Mm-hmm. It was more that, and Diane, I think you can also speak to this for sure, but it was more about they were speaking to the creative high in a very specific way that they all were really touching into that concept. And for Kathy, it was in many ways like a spiritual experience for her. Wes's talk so much about the creative high in his work. That's a lot of what he brings to his music. And then Jason just has this natural, I think his story is just so impactful and the sculpting, you know, the way that the sculpting comes through the camera. So, yeah, that was my thought, is that the creative high was really like culminating in that concept.
I'm wondering, one of the things that people, that is hinted at or sort of referenced in passing in, I think possibly most prominently in Wes, the Rock to Recovery guy, is the idea of seeing other people's stories or of sort of being able to relate to other people's stories and kind of seeing other people's experience of combating addiction. And so I'm wondering about the people in the film, if they've seen it, their sort of response to seeing themselves in conjunction with or in combination with the other people in the film, and if there's been either epiphanies or sort of sparks of recognition, or sort of what that reaction has been like, seeing sort of the tapestry of the film together.
Well, first of all, they've all seen the film, and that's been a real process of Diane and I really trying to figure out, okay, how is the best way for each person to see it? And we ended up, some of them, we watched it together with them. Some of them watched it on their own. And then we had a meeting with them afterwards to talk about it. We did do a private screening online, and some of them were there. And so we're able to talk to the audience, not necessarily to each other. Some of them know each other. But I think they're all like, they're all really proud of it. We've had a really incredible response from each of them in different ways. some of them will come to our live premiere that's happening soon, so they'll get to meet each other. But I think more it's going to be really interesting as other people in recovery start seeing it and we hear how they're resonating with it, that as it starts going out into the world. But I'm excited to have some of them hopefully interact and start connecting more. But we'll see how that happens. We're not sure in the larger picture over time.
Well, yeah. And I think also, you know, the process of being seen, you know, in this wider audience, you know, their artwork, it's empowering to them, you know. I mean, making art hopefully, you know, connects us deeper to ourselves. And then we want to bring that out into the world as artists. And so, you know, we do have an artist, she's a little shy, and she, you know, at first was like, oh, wow, this is really going to happen.
Yeah.
This is really going to happen. We're like, yeah, it's been a few years now. It's really happening.
Yeah, and this was 6 years. We did this. It took us 6 years to get to this point. So it has, they stuck with us. Some of them at some points, I think, were like, oh, we're kind of done. Can you stop bothering me? You know, because it just went on and on.
Yeah.
Well,
so great.
Well, also, I think, I mean, you have, again, since we were talking about sort of the breadth of artists, you have performance artists who are familiar with the idea of being presentational, sort of being in the public eye. But if you have someone who's a photographer or who's a painter, those are people who generally tend to, they have the capacity to send their artwork out into the world, and they don't have to necessarily follow the artwork with it. You have sort of different levels of public exposure, I guess, in that sense.
It's very vulnerable, too. I mean, it's been very vulnerable for some of them, obviously, like Diane was talking about, to get to this point, and not because it is showing their art, but it's also very just their stories, and that there's a lot of just that they're talking about trauma, and they're talking about things that are shameful to them, or things that you know, they've left in the past that they're revealing to us. So the vulnerability piece, you know, having to really support them and find ways to just help them, I think, along the way has been part of the process. So it's going to be interesting, again, to see, you know, hopefully people are going to be so inspired, but I'm sure this is going public, right? So it's a whole other ballgame now.
Well,
for all of us.
I noticed you mentioned theatrical, and I also think, well, they're wearing, a lot of our performers are wearing masks. Maybe Louise isn't so much, but he, you know, he was painted in our piece, right? So there is this kind of separation a little bit, you know, and unmasking that, like, this is who we are. And as Adriana was saying, the vulnerability in that of getting really real. With what happened to them and where they're at today.
It's interesting to sort of kind of round around to the idea of the artwork that's out there. That as I'd mentioned before we started recording, I was familiar with Victim's Family because I've been involved in the punk scene in the Bay Area for longer than perhaps I'd care to admit. But having seen Victim's Family, you know, back in the like late 80s, early 90s, and not really having, you know, there would be no reason for me to necessarily know the story behind Ralph. And then seeing him in this film makes me appreciate the artwork even more, in a sense. You know, and thinking back to my experience of having these songs that have followed me for decades now, and then sort of giving them an extra added heft, I think is really interesting. And the idea of the artwork gaining complexity and richness through knowing the stories behind it, I think, is another part of this film.
Yeah.
Well, Diane, do you want to... I was thinking that's a great segue for you, partly because of, you know, the way that documentary works. I mean, I agree that... all of a sudden there's this backstory that you hear that is influencing the music that, like you said, you've known this music for for such a long time, but then all of a sudden there's some backstory, or you know a little bit more what was happening for Rolf that you didn't know before. Mm-hmm. And I think for him, you know, he said to me that he had been approached many times to tell his story around addiction or do recovery films and things like that. And he was always like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. I don't want to, you know, that's like separate and maybe again, vulnerable, you know, you could ask him about that. But I think I felt so wonderful that he, and because he knew me, I think there was a comfort level to go forward. And I feel like he brings a lot to the film. So yeah. It's great to have him there as part of it.
I think too, musically, you see his music work in the beginning when it was just so raw, you know, and mm-hmm. you see him on stage and there, you know, and then you see the progression of his music and who he is, you know, and him becoming more settled with himself, you mm-hmm. know, and I thought, you know, I'm sure it was really important for him to go through that, you know, that letting it out, letting all of that out, whatever it was. And you feel that in the music, you know, and then looking at who he is today with what is that about today for him and in his creative process, you experience that. So
yeah. Plus we love his music. I mean the music that he's creating today is just phenomenal. I mean, I love it. And then we decided to end the credits with one of his songs that just comes in and kind of kicks in at the end. So
we just love
that
song.
Got a lot
song.
Of inspiration.
Yeah. Audrey and I were like, that is perfect. And we had worked with our sound designer, Dave Nelson, and he had suggested that. And we were just like, oh, yeah, that is perfect. And Adriana, you know, was like, yeah, let's do it, you know. But then we did have an original score also made at the end with someone else. And just combining those two. Yeah, and it worked so well.
Well, I mean, you have a lot of... the original score, but also you're using, there's Joan John Renault pieces that you bring in. And so, which also has a nice sort of San Francisco-ness to it that maybe is not necessarily overt, but sort of there's an undercurrent there.
Right.
Do you know her music?
How many songs?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wonderful. I love hers. You know, our trailer has a piece of hers on it, too. It just works so well with our stories. Yeah. How many pieces of music do we have in the film, Adriana?
I mean, the music is, it's like we could have a whole show just about the music.
Right.
Because, it was so complex. And there were so many times when Diane was like, no, because I kept saying, what about, we have another artist maybe that we could contribute. And you can imagine the releases, kind of doing all the releases and the licenses was a nightmare.
Oh, my God.
We have so many.
I was like, I can't do it anymore. And Adriana convinced me to continue. No more releases. There's only three more. There's only three more. You know.
I mean, really, it was crazy. But there's such a variety, and some of it is original from the artists like Brandon, Michael Randall, Dopeless is AKA Dopeless. Mm-hmm. You know, that's all of his original hip hop music. And then Rolf is all of his original music. And then we had to be very creative, like with Peter Griggs, Euphoria. There was one moment in the film that is one of my favorite moments where he's Freddie Mercury, and it was this gorgeous Queen song that was originally, we had it in the film before we found something to replace it, and that was really tough because we wanted to represent Peter in the most pure way we could, but we couldn't play a Queen song, and then you can't really do a cover song of Queen because that's a whole other ball of wax with licenses.
Right,
so then
exactly.
We had to, you know, figure out something. So Eamon Flynn, who did our opening closing piece, he crafted something there. And so, you know, there was a lot of complications and along the way, but we got a lot of local artists to donate music.
Did.
I don't know if you know The Gits. Have you heard of The Gits?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gregory?
Mm-hmm.
Steve Moriarty of The Gits. There's some music of his in the film, him and Dave Holmes. And then also there's a little moment of The Gits song over one of Rolf's piece. There was a lot of different, we were very creative along the way.
Maybe to round out, because we are starting to run out of time, we talked a little bit earlier about the people in the film sort of seeing themselves in conjunction with the other characters in the film. But I'm wondering, for the two of you, in the process of going through and hearing the stories and following the stories for a while, what were the moments that made you sort of stop and think about recovery or addiction differently? Were there moments of epiphany for you that particularly stood out of, oh, I had never thought of it that way before?
I'll have to, you know, for me, there's so many touchstones along the way. Going into this, I mean, I really wanted, it was a research project in many ways. Like, I want to talk to artists about their recovery and about creativity and how do they do it, you know, without drugs and alcohol, and how they've evolved over time. And because it's been an ongoing inquiry for me, and I actually feel like when I started after, a long sobriety stint, coming back to art through film has been both invigorating and incredibly provocative for me at times. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this process has stretched me. And there were times when I felt like I was on the edge. And if I didn't have a lot of ground in recovery, I could be like, you know what, I need a drink right now, because this is just trying to open up my creative life in this way is very confronting. Like, the inner critic is very alive at times for me. I felt like it kept challenging me to step up again and again. Collaboration is hard. And I think that talking to some of the artists and hearing, like, Peter has been so inspiring to me. He's so wise, and he really taught me a lot about his dedication to his craft. Louise taught me a lot about his challenges to find his recovery and tell his story without kind of getting re-traumatized or, you know, going
back
into
in.
His addictive cycle. Mm. Exactly. So many touchstones along the way. I could go on and on, but it's been such a learning process, and I'm so grateful for it, and continuing to be stretched as well.
And I think that's a perfect note to end on.
Right. Well, I just want to mention one thing too.
Mm-hmm.
Please, everyone, we would love them to join us online to watch the Creative High through the Roxy or through our other venues, and they can just go to our website at thecreativehigh.com.
We have been talking with Adriana Marchion and Diane Griffin, the director and producer of The Creative High, respectively. Thanks to both of you so much for talking with us today.
Hey, thank you so much for asking us.
And that was a conversation about the documentary The Creative High, which is going to be screening as part of this year's San Francisco Independent Film Festival. It's going to be screening in person on Sunday, February 6th at 7 p.m. over at The Roxy, but it will also be streaming online between February 3rd and February 13th. You can go to sfindie.com, that's sfindie.com, to find out more information about that screening and about all the various other screenings that are happening this year.